The rhyme I was always taught was you pick your T's, flatten your P's, widen your Q's. Were you guys for that?
Is that no, like, I like that one though.
That's a 90s. That must be it. It's a 1990s. Peak your T's, flatten your P's, and widen your QRS. Anyway.
Welcome to Kidney Essentials. This is a podcast for medical students, residents, and all nephrocurious practitioners at the University of Colorado and beyond. We're here to make nephrology more accessible, one podcast at a time. Let's start with introductions. Parisa?
Hi, everyone. I'm Parisa Mortaji. I'm a hospitalist at the University of Colorado, and I love all things kidney, and I love being part of this podcast.
Sarah?
Oh, I'm Sarah Young. I'm a nephrologist at the University of Colorado Hospitals, and I am an associate professor of clinical practice at the University of Colorado.
Nice. Do you tweet anywhere?
Oh, I do tweet. I tweet at Kidney Critic.
Nice. I still think that's a really clever Twitter handle. And I'm Sophia Ambruso. I'm a clinician educator at the University of Colorado in the Denver VA. So let's start with our mission statement. Parisa, do you want to do that one?
Sure. Our mission is to make nephrology more accessible, less intimidating, and provide concise nephrology pearls in each episode to help listeners understand renal pathophysiology, making nephrology sexy one episode at a time.
You're supposed to say, making nephrology sexy one episode at a time.
Only you do that well, Sophie.
All right, Sarah, you want to do the legal disclaimer?
This podcast is for educational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts. This podcast should not be used as medical advice or for treatment purposes. I don't know why, but the word podcast became very difficult to say.
Podcast.
So today we will be talking about hyperkalemia, and we will address the following learning objectives. One, define hyperkalemia, list some of the common etiologies of a high K, and understand the underlying physiology. Know the EKG findings associated with hyperkalemia, and learn management of acute hyperkalemia.
All right, fantastic. Parisa, let's get going with our case.
All right, so very cleverly, you have a patient named Mr. Cayley. He is a 72-year-old male. He has type 2 diabetes, heart failure with reduced ejection fraction with an EF of 35%. He's on losartan, spironolactone, and Lasix, and he presents with 2 days of nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. He states that his 2 grandchildren recently visited him, and they had some kind of illness, and he thinks he might have gotten sick from them. His respiratory viral panel is positive for influenza A. On lab testing, his potassium is 6.6, which is confirmed on a repeat BNP. We'll stop there for now and circle back to our case in a little bit, but let's back up real quick and lay some basic foundations for hyperkalemia. So, Sarah, what is a normal potassium level to you?
So, 6.6, definitely not normal. I would say a normal potassium is between 3.5 and 5. However, in patients with chronic kidney disease, we sometimes allow them to go closer to 5.5 without getting too anxious. I think it is important to mention, though, that the amount of potassium in your serum is so small compared to the amount that's in the cells. So while we measure extracellular potassium at 4 milliequivalents per liter, intracellular potassium is closer to 140 milliequivalents per liter. So most of your potassium in your body is actually in the cells themselves.
I actually go with 5.3 about my cutoff. Like when it goes above 5.3, when I'm managing somebody with hyperkalemia, that's when I'll start to wiggle a little bit in my chair and think, okay, do I want to start one medication or another? And if I want to do something concurrently to avoid that.
That's when you start getting a tachyarrhythmia?
It's not a tachyarrhythmia. It's like, well, I don't want to give this patient a tachyarrhythmia.
Why 5.3? Is that evidence-based or is that just your comfort number?
Yeah, it's not, I don't think it's evidence-based. I do think like the definition or what people's, I mean, the definition I think of true hyperkalemia is above 5. And there's actually studies that are done, which are flawed. And there's this U shape of hyperkalemia and increased mortality. And that's seen, I think it's 5, it might be 5.1, but with a potassium above 5 or 5.1, there's increased mortality. We know that probably the early mild hyperkalemia mortality rate risk is unrelated to the actual number being elevated, but perhaps a lot of the medications that get stopped if they are hyperkalemic. But I don't know, 5.3 is just a number probably that one of my attendings told me, and that stuck.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything magical about 5.3.
So above 5, we start to get concerned if they have CKD above, or 5.5 and above.
I would say with CKD, oftentimes we are going to tolerate hyperkalemia with all of their medications that they're on, right? Their RAS inhibition, their mineralocorticoid antagonists. I will certainly tolerate up to 5.3. Once I get beyond 5.3, I start to think, how do I want to shimmy with medications and other things to make sure we don't go higher than that?
I think the important thing to remember about hyperkalemia, the main thing is not the actual number itself, but the rate of change, because it's the rate of change that affects your ability of your myocardium to depolarize. So in our chronic patients, we're following their Ks regularly, and we know that they're sort of chronically high. But when someone just shows up with hyperkalemia, you have no idea what it was the day before. And if it was 3 the day before and now it's 6, that's more concerning than if it was 6 the day before and now it's 6.6.
Yeah, I can tell you, though, that I've never seen somebody with EKG changes with a potassium of 5.5.
I don't know. I've definitely had people who had very mild hyperkalemia that I was not worried about who progressed quickly to an arrhythmia. But usually their potassium was rising as we were evaluating them. So it's hard, you know, it's hard to know. The classic situation, which I've seen that happen, is rhabdo, you know, sure, where the person comes in and their first K is 5.3 and then their next K is 6.5. I feel like we might be getting ahead of the script here, though. Just a tidbit.
Yeah. We try to avoid conversation like this because we did this once and we went for like an hour and a half and we had to completely re-record it. So let's get back to the script.
Okay.
Teresa, keep us in line, man.
Alrighty. So moving on from a normal potassium level, what types of signs and symptoms can we see with hyperkalemia that would make us concerned?
I think one of the most common complaints from patients is muscle weakness. And as one of my attendings once said, they come in and they say, my legs and my arms feel like spaghetti. But the thing is that it can progress and be as severe as causing diaphragm paralysis, respiratory failure. Respiratory failure.
Oh, what? Were you from the South?
Failure.
I thought that was intentional.
No. No. Rarely are my speech impediments intentional. Paresthesias can also occur. And then what we worry about are the conduction or abnormalities. But oftentimes patients are asymptomatic with those. And we don't notice that until we get an EKG.
Okay. So speaking of EKGs and symptoms, the resident in the emergency room tells us that the patient denies any muscle pain, no weakness, no palpitations, but it sounds like that really shouldn't stop us from being worried and we should still pursue a stat EKG. So what are some EKG findings that are associated with hyperkalemia?
The rhyme I was always taught was you peak your T's, flatten your P's, widen your QRS. Were you guys for that?
Is that like, no, I like that one, though.
That's a 90s. It's a 1990s. Peak your T's, flatten your P's, and widen your QRS. Anyway. Yeah, so the classic finding is peak T waves. And it can't just be a peaked T wave. Like, that doesn't count. It really has to be in more than one lead, and typically in your precordial leads. And then you can have prolonged a PR or P wave flattening, and patients can progress to heart block or bradycardia. And then, of course, there can be widening of your QRS until it merges with your T-wave to give you the sinus wave pattern that I'm sure all of you have seen.
But, Sarah, maybe you want to just describe briefly what a sine wave looks like.
Well, perhaps you would like to do that, Sophie, because I'm not really sure I have the words for that.
I mean, I would just say a sine wave is going up and down, just, you know, like one squiggle. One sort of... okay, maybe I can't describe it either.
Well, I had no words. At least you had some words. That's like all I can say.
Yeah, yes, just an S repeating itself. There you go. But I do want to just mention, too, an important thing is sometimes people will be like, is this a peaked T wave or not? And they see it, you know, across the precordium. And the real question is, do I need to worry about this? And then if it's available, you should look at previous EKGs. And that can be very helpful, at least previous EKGs when the patient does not have a history of hyperkalemia. And I say that because we have a lot of patients who come in all the time with hyperkalemia. And so they have to have not have hyperkalemia and have demonstrated having similar peak T waves in the past.
Agreed. It's the combination of the EKG in the setting of the clinical context, right?
Okay, so now that we have that fund of knowledge, our patient's EKG comes back showing flattened P waves and some peaked T waves. We look at his prior EKGs and these findings were not present. How does this affect the way that you all would think about this case?
Well, even though the patient is asymptomatic, this patient does have true changes. You said that it's not old, it's something new. So flattened P waves, peak T waves, these are all concerning for cardiac conduction abnormalities. So this is concerning, and I would move forward with trying to do further interventions.
Okay.
Emergent interventions.
Sorry, that okay sounded very nonchalant. Before we get into emergently treating this patient, I just wanted to back up and think about etiologies that we should be considering at this point. So how do you think about causes of acute hyperkalemia and what should kind of be our thought process to think through the differential?
Well, I think you did a nice job when you were making this script because you put it into sort of three buckets, which the first bucket would be pseudohyperkalemia. And then the second bucket is an increased release from intracellular to extracellular space or an inability to move potassium into the cell. So a redistribution that's inappropriate of potassium from the intracellular space to the extracellular space or an inability to move it from the extracellular space into your intracellular space. And then, of course, there can be an imbalance between the potassium intake and excretion. That's the third bucket. And this really is unusual. It really requires someone to have impaired potassium excretion because, you know, keeping your potassium in that very narrow range is essential to maintaining your life. So your kidney has gone to extreme measures to maintain a very narrow potassium concentration. And so it's not easy to eat your way into danger or, if that makes any sense, unless you have a problem with your kidney. So no one should worry about going home eating a bunch of bananas and giving themselves hyperkalemia because the vast, vast majority of us are protected by that.
Yeah, unless you have problems with your kidney or you're on a medication or have some sort of medical problem that impairs your ability to excrete potassium.
Exactly.
Okay, so for scenario number one, pseudohyperkalemia, what types of things could lead to that?
Well, the most common thing we see in the hospital is it's phlebotomy related, and it's just that the red blood cells have hemolyzed a little and some potassium has spilled out. And the amount of hemolysis that occurs with phlebotomy in the hospital constantly surprises me. I feel like every other sample is hemolyzed.
And I was like, they got the sample and they like gave it a good shake.
I know. You know? It's like shake weight. Let's mess up with those RBCs. And then, you know, rarely we see someone who has just a huge number of other types of cells, you know, either leukocytes or platelets, and they get hyperkalemia from that. From those cells breaking up. I recently admitted a patient with a white count of 200,000.
What was the potassium?
Actually, I'm going to go look. I don't remember. It wasn't a problem. I put her on CRT, but those are the people who get, you know, severe hyperkalemia.
Yeah, they get that big white blood cell count, and those white cells are super, super fragile. Like they're just sort of damaged, fragile cells, so they're easily lyse.
Yeah. We don't see that as often as you would think, even at the university where we're seeing people like, you know, coming in with white counts of 200 and stuff. What does happen is typically when you have a white count that high, the hematologists are going to want to give you something to kill all those cells. And then when they kill all those cells release the potassium, and then that's real. And then you have to be ready to treat it.
Among other electrolyte disorders.
Yes. But that's another podcast for another day.
All right, now it's my turn. I get to present a little bit of data myself. So the BMP states that the potassium was confirmed on repeat testing and there was no mention of hemolysis, because that's what we do. We look for the lab saying, oh, there was some hemolysis here, and then we say, okay, let's get a repeat. The white blood cell count was 6.3 and platelets were 250,000, which is within normal range. So this represents a true hyperkalemia.
Okay, so it sounds like for our patient, we've ruled out pseudo-hyperkalemia. Moving on to scenario number two, what types of things could cause increased potassium release from the intracellular to the extracellular space?
So yeah, we've sort of talked about this once before, and I just want to rephrase the way we're talking about it, because it could be release of potassium from inside the cells to outside of the cells, or it could be an inability to move the potassium from outside of the cells to the inside. So hyperosmolality, as seen with hyperglycemia, will pull potassium out of the cells with solvent drag and cause hyperkalemia. But the other confounding factor in that situation is usually you don't have enough insulin around, and so you can't move the potassium back into the cell. And so one of the things that protects all of us from becoming hyperkalemic, for example, today my son ordered crumble cookies. Have you guys had those?
Yes, they're insane.
There was a dulce de leche one, so how could I not eat that entire thing? So I ate the entire dulce de leche thing, and my glucose spiked up, and it had potassium in it, because there was also a peanut butter one, which I happened to consume too. And my potassium increased.
Yeah, those are such big cookies.
I know.
Sarah, I would have been a comatose on the table.
But fortunately, after my glucose spiked, my insulin then spiked, and all that potassium that I ingested in that peanut butter cookie just got shoved into my cells, right? Until I could excrete it in my urine. But in patients who have kidney disease, they can't excrete it, or if they have diabetes and they don't have insulin, they can't move it into the cells. So a lack of insulin will lead to the potassium sitting outside of your cells and not moving appropriately intracellularly. So that was my story about my crumble cookies, and no one will ever forget the effects of glucose and insulin in the setting of hyperkalemia.
What other causes do we want to add to the hyperglycemia etiology?
So I think another one that has to do with shifting is a metabolic acidosis. Because if you've got too many hydrogen ions, they're going to move into the cell. And to maintain electroneutrality, we're going to have potassium that's going to move out of the cell. So that's maintaining some degree of balance. This patient's bicarb is 18, so it might be contributing a little bit, but I'm not too sure how much it's contributing. It's not like, I don't know what the pH, but it doesn't seem like it's contributing dramatically. Some other specific drugs are notable for contributing to shifting. Beta blockers can do this. Digoxin actually blocks the sodium potassium ATPase, so that can do that as well. Mannitol is going to cause that increased osmolality, so that's going to cause a shift. And then if you do blood cell transfusion, you're going to be giving lots, like an influx of extra red blood cells. You can have some potassium leakage or some cell lysis.
You know, it's interesting. Until I came to the university, I'd never heard the term shift them. I trained at the university. We didn't use it back then. And people would say to me, I shifted them. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about?
And that's a new age term.
Really? I feel like we've used that since I was in med school.
That shows how young you are.
I like that you use the positive way to describe it. It shows how young you are.
All right, we can move on.
Okay, so back to our patient. Even though he has diabetes, his glucose is 150, so not super concerning. His bicarb is 18, his GAP is 14, and his UA is bland. So we touched on this a little bit, but just to kind of finish off, what leads to scenario number three, decreased urinary excretion of potassium?
Well, anytime you have a decrease in your GFR, you can't filter potassium, and this is particularly bad in patients who have a decreased GFR and no or minimal urine flow, because you need both a GFR, and some distal sodium delivery to your distal tubule to manage potassium excretion. And so urinary obstruction is a very common cause of hyperkalemia and acute kidney injury. And you can fix it really quickly. And sometimes you don't have to shift these people or do anything. All you have to do is put a Foley in them. You fix their renal failure, you fix their hyperkalemia.
You mean Foley catheter? You mean a catheter up through the urethra into the bladder, making sure everybody knows what a Foley is.
Okay, yeah, we should go back and also explain what shifting is at some point. So a Foley catheter, yes. Isn't that the one that you placed in the wrong orifice at one time, Sophie,
that
during
wasn't
your medical
me.
School? Oh my gosh.
Wait, I've never had one. I've never placed one in the wrong orifice.
Okay, I remember that from an earlier podcast, but I might be forgetting.
No, we were talking about somebody pulling from the balloon.
No, this is earlier. This is an earlier podcast. We had a podcast where we talked about the mistakes since we had made. And I thought you had a story about being in the OR.
Oh, no. Oh, I couldn't find it. I couldn't find the urethra.
Anyway, this should all be edited out. Needless to say.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yes, a Foley catheter in the urethra to relieve the obstruction and to help treat the hyperkalemia and to help with potassium excretion. The other really common causes of hyperkalemia from decreased urinary excretion include patients with acute kidney injury, especially if they're oliguric or anuric, and patients with chronic kidney disease.
And then the one to add on to that is anything that's going to affect the kidney's ability to excrete urine that's not related to chronic kidney disease. So we have a lot of medications that can impact our ability to do that. Most commonly are ACEs and our ARBs, so our angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, and our angiotensin receptor blockers, our calcineurin inhibitors, which are immunosuppressants, our heparin. And the reason why heparin is because it actually blocks the production of aldosterone, which is kind of cool. NSAIDs do that. That has to do with basically hemodynamics of the glomerulus, potassium-sparing diuretics like mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists.
Okay, so circling back to our patient, we already know that he is taking losartan and spironolactone. Some more lab data, and we already mentioned that his UA is bland. His post-void residual, meaning after he urinated, we scanned his bladder to see how much urine was still in there, and he still had 750 cc's in his bladder. His creatinine is 2.4 from a baseline of 0.8. With all this data in mind, it seems like he most definitely has decreased urinary potassium excretion.
Yeah, so a post-void residual is basically after someone pees, you put an ultrasound on their bladder or on their supra-umbilical or supra-pubic space, the skin.
Definitely not supra-umbilical.
I know.
Unless they have 3 liters in their bladder.
I've seen that.
Yes.
And there's suprapubic space, and you are measuring. It's just this like basic ultrasound measuring bladder volume. And so there should be very literal, like after someone pees, that bladder should be completely emptied. So you really shouldn't be able to measure much. In somebody who's a gentleman of some vintage, they might have an enlarged prostate and they may have some retention, but certainly not 750 milliliters.
Anything above 150, we usually say, could be causing enough pressure to the kidney and leading to renal insufficiency. So 750 is well above that.
Oh, wow. 150? I feel like my threshold is higher.
If you're looking for a cause as to why somebody's got progressive chronic kidney disease and you don't have an explanation, I mean, you're kind of looking for everything and say, okay, we're going to consider this and consider this. I think 150... in my personal opinion, is a little bit low, but maybe that's because I work with veterans and that's really, really common for me to see.
150 seems low, but the truth is that's after you pee, right? Like it's after it being empty, they should really be zero.
And the last thing, which I feel like a lot of people are curious about and we already touched upon, is how much does increased intake contribute to hyperkalemia?
Yeah, so this really doesn't cause hyperkalemia unless you have some other disruption in your potassium homeostasis. And Sophie mentioned earlier drugs that can do that, or inability to move potassium into your cells, like a diabetic who have an insulin deficiency. Typically, this really only happens in patients who have chronic kidney disease and can't increase their urinary potassium excretion. And they can get into trouble with things like salt substitute, potassium supplements that someone slapped on them because they started them on Lasix or TPN or other nutritional supplements. And then certain foods certainly can get them into trouble. Avocados, spinach, potatoes, oranges, bananas, coconut water, and dried fruits.
But really, if someone doesn't have underlying kidney disease, they shouldn't worry.
No.
Like, even if they're buying, you know, over-the-counter potassium supplements to help with their muscle cramps, it really shouldn't cause a problem.
Nope.
Typically not. I mean, if that patient is, you know, a diabetic and they're hyperglycemic, that they may have a greater issue. But really, the kidney is incredibly efficient at excreting potassium.
Now, they could get themselves into trouble if they gave themselves another problem. Like, they continue to take the potassium supplements and didn't drink anything and gave themselves acute kidney injury. Or they took the potassium supplements and took spironolactone at the same time. But just intake, if you have normal kidney function, will not get you into trouble.
One of the most common things that probably you guys as hospitalists see but may not necessarily recognize is if somebody comes in and they're really volume depleted, they're not getting that sodium delivery to the distal nephron.
Bingo.
And if you can't get sodium, you can't actually exchange a potassium into the urine, so you can't excrete potassium. So if you just actually volume replete them, you'll correct their potassium issue.
Yeah.
And you'll oftentimes see them have a little bit of a metabolic acidosis along with it. It's actually a hyperkalemic RTA.
Wow. Okay.
Or they can have a contraction alkalosis from their vomiting. There's also, there are all sorts of things that can happen. But yeah, but that's only if you have basically some prevenal azotemia, poor urinary distal sodium delivery.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So just to summarize, Sarah, what do we think is causing hyperkalemia in our patient now that we have all the data?
Well, it sounds like he has a lot of reasons for hyperkalemia. He has a low GFR with acute kidney injury. He has impaired distal excretion of potassium due to the medications that he is on, including spironolactone and losartan, and due to urinary retention.
This is very common just for patients that we see in the hospital. We always kind of want to find a slam dunk. This one thing is what's causing the lab abnormality, but usually it's multifactorial.
There's a reason for that, right? Because if potassium homeostasis is so essential to existence that you had to have some backup reasons, like you just can't block one mechanism of homeostasis without others compensating. You have to kind of block a bunch of different areas before you're going to get into trouble.
And that makes sense. Okay, so let's move on to the fun stuff, management of acute hyperkalemia. Sophie, what is your general approach?
So number one, before I get to actual approach, I would say if it's less than 6, I might be a little bit less aggressive overall. If it's 6 and above, I probably will be more aggressive no matter what. But on top of that, if I see EKG changes, I'm absolutely going to be treating this patient emergently. If I have a potassium of 6 or above, I'll probably be doing that as well. If there's no EKG changes, I'll check for a pseudohyperkalemia. I'll look for, looking for hemolysis on the labs, and I'll redraw them. The other thing I might consider is I'll try and really quick go through my brain, what could the potential cause be? Like, what is this patient coming in with? What are they complaining on? Are they on any other medications? You know, if I think I can just put a Foley in somebody and correct their hyperkalemia, I may not have to do everything else. If I can just give them some normal saline or some lactated ringers, I may not have to do everything else. So trying to treat this patient, you know, understanding what the underlying mechanism is helpful. Sometimes we don't know immediately. So if we do have absolute EKG changes, we go to the algorithm of treating emergently. None, then you need to work up everything else. And then, of course, determining the etiology is most important so you can long-term make some changes.
So when thinking about treating acute hyperkalemia, there are three goals that I keep in mind, just kind of generally speaking as a hospitalist. The first and most important goal is to stabilize the cardiac membrane. The second is to increase intracellular uptake to rapidly decrease the serum potassium. And the third, more long-term goal is to excrete that excess potassium from the body. As nephrologists, what would you all have to add to this?
I was just going to repeat what I think Sophie sort of already alluded to, which is you really do want to focus your treatment on the clinical situation. So if they are pre-renal, you want to treat them with volume. You know, if they have a urinary retention, treat their urinary retention. Stop the medicines that are contributing in addition to the above goals.
Okay, great. So starting with goal one, stabilizing the cardiac membrane. Sophie, can you walk us through what you use to do this?
So classically, or all, I guess all the time, we use calcium chloride or gluconate. Typically, I use calcium gluconate to stabilize the cardiac myocytes, and it prevents arrhythmias. It's basically, and I can never remember how it shifts us from the depolarization perspective, but it's basically stabilizing that pathway, and it prevents arrhythmias when we see the EKG changes. I will repeat the dose if the EKG changes have not improved with that dose while I'm trying to do other things.
Okay, so thankfully the ED has already given our patient a gram of calcium gluconate and a liter of IV fluids. An hour later, his potassium is still 6.4 and EKG changes are improved, but it looks like there are still some peak T waves in the precordial leads. Would you recommend an additional dose of calcium gluconate in this case?
This happens all the time, and I don't know. I get a little nervous with people just redosing the calcium on and on because that's not the solution here, right? What this guy really needs is a folate because he's got 750 mL in his bladder, right? And so I feel like sometimes people are like, they give calcium and then they like put them in an ED room and wait for the ICU. And I'm like, dude, that's not going to do it. Like, you got to put the Foley in downstairs, you know, we got to do all this other stuff downstairs.
Yeah, I think the point is like, yes, I think it can be repeated because it is short duration. In the meantime, we should be doing a whole heck of a lot of other things to be bringing that number down.
Absolutely.
And just repeated dose of calcium gluconate is that's like sweeping the Sahara Desert, right? You're not doing much. You've done probably all you can with what you've given. And who knows what you're bringing the calcium level to. I'm sure if you bring a calcium level to 12, it's not going to make any additional difference in how somebody depolarizes and saving the cardiac membrane or quote unquote stabilizing the cardiac membrane. So I agree. I think maybe redose once, but be doing everything else because that's really the tip of the iceberg.
It's really there just to give you time to do everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to goal two of treatment, shifting the potassium from the extracellular to intracellular space to rapidly decrease serum potassium. Sarah, what would you use to achieve this goal?
So the important thing is that they need insulin. Now, if their sugar is not high, then you need to give them the glucose too, so that you don't make them hypoglycemic. So typically these patients get a dose of insulin and D50, usually 10 units of regular and an amp of D50. You can also use albuterol. It's not real effective in reducing your serum potassium, but it always makes me feel better. So I give it anyway, in addition if their potassium is really high. It is going to give them a tachyarrhythmia, but they'll always feel very comfortable when they're hyped up on albuterol. And, you know, traditionally we used to give all these people bicarbonate too, but we don't do that anymore unless they're severely acidotic.
So we will definitely recommend to give our patient some insulin and an amp of D50. And then the third, more long-term goal, how can we excrete the excess potassium from the body?
Yeah, so I think this is where we get into the point is you need to figure out where the problem is. For this patient, because we think this patient is retaining urine, then to get them to excrete, we put a Foley catheter in them. And unless this patient has had prolonged urinary obstruction and their kidneys are really dilated and it's going to be a while before they wake up and they're able to actually excrete or do anything meaningful, you put the Foley catheter and we anticipate that the potassium is going to come down really quickly. In a patient who's volume depleted, who has no distal delivery of sodium, if you volume replete them and you correct that hyponatremia, then they're able to then perfuse their kidneys again. They're going to start dumping potassium that way. And then beyond that, we need to start considering, okay, is this patient volume down? That would be, of course, giving them volume. Is this patient volume up and they have heart failure? Then maybe we want to select a diuretic, something to make them pee out potassium. The diuretics that are effective at peeing out potassium is most likely we'd reach for a loop diuretic like furosemide, but thiazide diuretics work for this as well. If this patient has an acute kidney injury and we're not anticipating kidney recovery for a time period, or they have chronic kidney disease or advanced chronic kidney disease, then we need to consider something like dialysis to clear that potassium. And then finally, the next things that you consider is there something that we can do to bind potassium in the gut? Historically, people used K-exalate, but that's kind of not necessary anymore, at least in the developed world. So we have other things like Lokelma and Veltessa, sodium zirconium cyclosilicate, or Pterimer, and both of those bind potassium in the gut. And so those are other ways to bring potassium down that way.
I have seen some people give like a liter of IV fluids and then chase it with Lasix.
Hell yeah.
What's up with that?
So I have done this, and obviously we make nephrologists, we usually make fun of people who give fluids and Lasix at the same time. But this is one of the few situations in which it might be helpful. And that's just because you have somebody you need them to get enough sodium, and then you need to make sure that sodium gets to their distal tubule. So the setting in which I would do that is someone who I don't want to dialyze, but their K is really high. They need volume, but I also need to make sure that volume gets to their distal tubule so I can bring their potassium down.
Why would it not get to the distal tubule? Like, does the Lasix make it get there faster, or?
If they're sodium avid. So, for example, take a cirrhotic who there's no way you're ever going to not make them sodium avid, right? And so they need both sodium and you want to get rid of that sodium at the same time and get rid of potassium at the same time. So that's a way to do it. I mean, I don't do this regularly, but it works.
Okay. Sarah, can you summarize the management plan for our patient?
I would love to do that. So calcium gluconate is indicated because the patient has EKG changes. You can repeat it if you need to, but we really want to emphasize shifting the potassium from the extracellular space intracellularly with insulin and glucose and increasing excretion of potassium with Lokelma and the Foley to relieve his obstruction, and then hold all his medications, including his Losartan, Spiro, and Lasix, and if they are underperfused and have acute kidney injury because they are prenatal, you would also want to give them IV fluids.
All right, thank you. It sounds like our patient has a lot of factors that likely contributed to his hyperkalemia, but this is commonly what we see in the hospital, like we already touched on, so I think it's really helpful to go through all of the pillars of management for his case. Sophie, can you start us out with a summary of the learning points?
Sure. So number one, acute hyperkalemia, meaning a potassium of approximately greater than 5.5. So for acute hyperkalemia, treat immediately for a potassium greater than 6. I specifically would treat, even without EKG changes, with a potassium greater than 6. I may not be quite as worried, but I'd treat for that. Certainly, I'd be treating 100% for a potassium greater than 6.5, regardless of EKG findings. And then the big buckets for hyperkalemia for causes are 1, pseudohyperkalemia, 2, increased intracellular release, and 3, impaired urinary excretion of potassium.
And the major EKG findings are you peak your T waves, you prolong your PR, flatten your P wave, widen your QRS, and that can lead to a sine wave. Management of acute hyperkalemia, remember to stabilize your cardiac membranes, shift the potassium intracellularly, and excrete excess potassium.
Sarah, will you sing your...
Peak your T's, flatten your P's, widen your QRS.
one above my head up and down.
Okay, credits. Sophie and Patricia for editing, Josh John for graphics, and the University of Colorado School of Medicine and the Division of Nephrology for giving us our jobs.
And the VA for me. Thanks, everybody, for joining us.